This is Mouth Media Network, your inside voice.
It's almost 100% mindset. The idea of overwhelm is 100% mindset, I would say. Because if you could step outside yourself for a minute and say that, what if I wasn't overwhelmed? I mean, how would I deal with this problem? Right? So you take that out of the equation. It's like, well, this person needs this and this person needs this. If I had $1 million at my disposal and 50 people working for me and I wasn't stressed out about this, how would I deal with this? Now you can start to attack it. Because if you can identify a sort of strategic direction for any of these problems, then it's really not a problem. It's just a matter of time.
If anyone had a right to be overwhelmed, it's Ari Maizel. At 23 years old, he was working in high-stakes real estate, and he was in debt to the tune of $3 million. He was finding himself so exhausted that he could sometimes only work an hour a day. Then he was informed via a voicemail from his doctor that he had an autoimmune disease, one that could mean just two things, surgery or maybe death. Ari accepted neither. In fact, he created a third option, living better. By doing relentless research and testing on his own body, he found a path to not only healing himself, but building out a process of hacking his own life into a structured program that has led him to a high level of success in coaching others via his company, Less Doing. He helps people hack their own lives for better personal and professional productivity. And I'm one of them. Coming up, you'll hear how being busy is not really a badge of honor, why to-do lists are ineffective, why being irreplaceable may not be a good thing, the reason Ari won't travel for the next year, and how protecting the entrepreneurial team from the entrepreneurial mindset is paramount.
This is Million Dollar Mind, remarkable stories of transformation and how to shift your mindset to accelerate success with entrepreneur, author, and mindset expert Julia Pimsleur.
Ari, good to see you.
You too, always.
How's it going today?
Good, good. Running around as usual, but good.
Well, I've been excited to talk to you. I often refer to you in my life as the guy who gave me back 30% of my time.
30%? That's pretty good.
Yeah, okay. It's a pretty high number.
I like that, yeah.
I remember when I met you back when I had two kids and was running Little Pim and serving on boards and doing what felt like way too much. And I just remember thinking, either I have to give up a whole bunch of this, all of which I loved, or find a way of doing it better. And then you just like appeared in my life, like when the student is ready, the teacher appears. And I just remember learning so many practical, tactical things that really rocked my world and gave me back, 30% of my time. So thank you. And it's so fun to have you here to share you with my listeners.
Well, you're welcome. That's the best thing I could possibly hear. So, and I actually don't even remember how we got connected originally and how we found each other. But I do remember coming to your offices on Union Square, I think it was, and
there
were stacks and stacks of Little Pim books everywhere, and everybody sort of cramped in. It was a pretty tight space for all that. You had a large group of people.
It was, and we were like a really small team trying to get a ton done. And I remember this one thing you taught me about putting the filter on my inbox so that everything that had unsubscribe in it went into optional. Uh-huh. And it was like magic. Like half of my inbox disappeared in one stroke, and I just felt like 30 pounds lighter, and from then on, I was so much more productive. And that was just like one of, 10 fantastic things that you taught me.
Well, the funny thing about email is, and still it's constantly comes up, is that whenever I speak anywhere around the world, wherever, I always like to ask people what their biggest productivity challenge is. And email often, almost always actually comes up as the number one thing. And the reason is that the email problem is not an email problem, it's a decision-making problem. And we just have too many opportunities to make too many decisions in a given day as a founder, as an entrepreneur, that gets magnified a lot. So,
and as a parent, right? I remember that was another reason I wanted to work with you. I was like, if he has four kids and he actually is running a successful business and is a nice guy, he's figured something out. I want to learn from him.
Figure something out. There's always more to learn.
Yes. Well, and I want to come back to all the productivity stuff, but I wanted to start with a question, which is, do you think that you've had success because of or in spite of or both?
Because of or in spite of what?
You fill in the blank.
So I think that from the outside, it would probably look like in spite of. To me, it's very much because of. And the of, I guess, in this case is restrictions and limits. And if you can imagine, right, being 23 years old, working 18 hours a day on a construction site in real estate, finding yourself in $3 million of personal debt, and then getting diagnosed with a chronic illness that's considered to be incurable, which knocks you down from being an 18-hour-a-day hard-charging bull to struggling to get an hour of work done on a given day.
That was you at 23.
That was me at 23.
Wow. Right here in New York, right?
Right here. Yeah. And you ask somebody who works a 9-to-5 job, you say, what would you do if you only could work till 4, right? And it's an easy answer for most people to say, well, I'd skip lunch or something. But if you ask the same person, what would you do if you could only work an hour a day? It's such a mind-bendingly difficult problem. And the truth is, at the time, there was no productivity system in place that would help with that issue, as far as I was aware of. So that's where the idea came from. But for me, those innovations have always come from extreme restrictions. And I always look at, like, I think about MacGyver, right? I don't know if you're ever a fan of MacGyver, but nobody ever said to MacGyver, hey, there's a Home Depot across the street. Go get whatever you need and go across the street and blow up that building, right? It was always like, here's a paperclip and a box of Bisquick. Go blow up the building. And he would. So to me, these restrictions are where the innovations come from. And a lot of times, even when founders are struggling to raise money and things like that, sometimes the abundance of resources that they actually get stifle that ability to come up with innovations, doesn't force them to think more critically and strategically about how they do things. So if you are presented with a situation where you simply, the restrictions are there, there's nothing you can do, you either give up or you come up with a solution. And that's what I ended up doing.
Can you take me back to what it was like when you first found out you had the Crohn's disease? Because now you've gotten that under control. You're like totally on the other side of it. But there might be people listening who are struggling, maybe not with Crohn's disease, but with some other either health setback or limitations in their own life physically. What did it feel like when you would like wake up in the morning at 23, even before you knew you had Crohn's disease? Like what was going on for you?
I mean, the thing was, at the time, as I was literally in $3 million of debt. I had built this big real estate project. I hadn't sold anything yet. I eventually did. It just took a lot longer. And I think I probably felt like a failure at the time, you know. And as many times as you can see those quotes about failure being the path to success, it doesn't feel like it when you're in it.
Totally. Like when you woke up in the morning, what was like the first thing you thought about?
I think I probably just felt hopeless in a lot of ways, honestly. The interesting thing for me was that I had met the woman who would become my wife a month before I was diagnosed. So there was like a lot going on, you know, it was just a lot of things. And it was really hard to focus. And it was really hard to know if any decisions I was making were the right ones, which is a really crazy place to be if you think about it. It's almost like being in the Matrix and not knowing it. So you start doubting a lot of things. And I think that confidence is one of the most important things an entrepreneur can have. And it's also the hardest thing to hold on to. And I certainly didn't have it at the time.
And did you have to like adjust your lifestyle around having the symptoms of the Crohn's disease? Like what did you have to do?
Well, so one of the things is I was put on a lot of medicine very quickly. I think within 3 or 4 months, I was on about 16 pills a day. And those had their own sort of debilitating side effects. So I just felt, you know, the truest sense of the word, I felt sick. I felt broken and ill. And not just, you know, in my gut, everything about me just felt broken. So getting the motivation to change that didn't come until later, because as bad as that sounds, it wasn't bad enough to make me make a change. And a lot of people, I think, who've become successful talk about there's been some breaking point or some catalyst that's on that. And it's unfortunate in a lot of cases that we have to get to that point. You know, so for me, it was, I think.
Yeah, what happened?
That it might have been 2
pushed
years.
Pushed you over the edge.
Yeah, I think it was probably 2.5 years or so after my initial diagnosis. I had been in the hospital one night, which wasn't the first time. But this one, there was just something different about this time. It just felt like I might not make it out of the hospital. And I just told myself if I got out of there, I was going to do something different. And all I did was really, it was did the exact opposite of everything that I'd been doing to that point. I went like the extreme opposite, diet, exercise, everything. And it started to work. And the biggest thing I can point to is I think that the biggest antidote to stress is control. And when you're in a fight with your body, whether it's a chronic illness, stress, weight gain, any of these things, you feel like you're out of control. And it's very, very hard to get that back into control. It's a, such an important, such a like a base human need to have some sense of control on the things that we do.
Did you read anything or talk to anyone that helped you get to that place? Or was it really just like you alone in your hospital bed, like, I'm done, I have to find a different way?
Yeah, it was really like me alone. I mean, the thing is this is 15 years ago. The disease is still not incredibly well understood. There's a lot of different mechanisms that they believe cause it and affect it. And so at the time, it was one of those things where you Google it and it's like, well, you're going to have surgery and or you're going to die basically from like, you know, colon cancer.
Great prospect.
Right, right. Exactly. So, I mean, I was diagnosed by voicemail, which is kind of funny.
Come on.
Yeah.
Tell me that story.
Yeah. That's not the doctor I ended up working with, but I went to see a doctor for the testing and he left me a voicemail. I was like, oh, well, you have Crohn's disease and you're going to take these pills. Yeah. And I was 20, 23 and it was like
a gut punch. Of course,
if
it was today, it might have been a text, right?
That could yeah, right.
Dude. Crohn's disease.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then like an emoji or two.
Right. Wow. So, okay. So you hit this place where you were like, this sucks and I'm either going to be in and out of hospitals and on medication or potentially die. Now, not everybody would then make the decision to become like a biohacker and figure out their own way forward. What do you think about how you were raised or books you read or people who inspired you or like what made you able to turn that corner in a way to find a positive way forward?
I'm sure there's an element of luck to it, you know, yeah. Which I think would be silly to deny that. And the other thing, too, is that the medicine that I was on really did help to the extent that I was able to make this change. The problem with most chronic illnesses is that the medicines work until they don't because people don't make a change. So I think that I'd always been sort of a tinkerer. Mm-hmm. I'm used to breaking things and fixing them in different ways. And there's just, I guess, an entrepreneurial spirit to that in itself. In fact, there's some amazing research that says that entrepreneurs are basically an evolutionary irritant.
An evolutionary irritant.
That we just kind of like mess things up, you know, to make them better. And that's why I actually see a lot of entrepreneurs become very self-sabotaging. If they don't have a problem to fix, they will make
disrupt their own lives.
Yeah. That's why a lot of entrepreneurs get divorced. There's and the risk tolerances that other people don't. There's really, it's kind of an interesting play on it, I'd say. But I was up against the wall. It was that or something or nothing.
So what did you start doing? What was like the first thing you did that then shifted things for you?
So through a really weird miscommunication on my part with my doctor, I had basically become almost phobic of greens of any kind for several months before that, which is the exact opposite of what I should have been doing. And so I immediately switched that. And I think I was vegan for maybe 3 weeks because that didn't quite work out for me. And then I went vegetarian for probably 5 or 6 months. And then I was pescatarian for several. But that period where I was vegetarian, all of those things that I was eating were things that would have normally given me problems. And I really saw my intestines as like a muscle that was basically becoming weak and I needed to strengthen it. So it didn't feel great at first necessarily, but I started to build up and started to feel better about things. But the biggest thing for me was just having some element of control over what was happening. I started looking at data. I had been getting blood tests for every 5 weeks for over a year at that point. I'd had colonoscopies, endoscopies, all sorts of things. And I just started to crunch numbers. And honestly, at this point, I can't even say that data told me anything, but it felt like it was at the time, you know, owning that data. Because I was just getting these reports and putting them in a drawer. And so just starting to like experiment, look at myself in an experiment. And again, I don't even know if any of my experiments actually worked individually, right? But I was doing it. I wasn't a passenger anymore.
And how would you describe that mindset shift? Like, what do you think was the shift if you had to describe?
Passenger to driver, honestly. And I think that that's what happens a lot. I think that's how it happens in marriages. I think that's what happens as a parent sometimes, with two parents, rather, obviously. I think that's what happens in the workplace as well. I think that a lot of people get very complacent. They become passengers in what's happening, and they stop taking an active role in where they're going, how fast they're going there, and how smooth the ride is.
I love that. And I know that whenever I've hit speed bumps or actual, face plants in my own career and personal life, I always adopt this mentality of like what I call accelerate into the turn, which is like when you're going into a harsh turn right on the road, your instinct or mind is to like slow down because it's scary.
Right.
But in fact, you have to hit the gas, right? Because you got to get through that turn.
Right.
And so I think part of that accelerating into the turn is like, yeah, do the data research, like crunch the numbers, figure out which part of this you can control. And then you start to feel a little bit like, all right, I can see the other side of it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And even if you actually can't, right, you convince yourself that you can.
Yeah. So then what happened? Like, how did you then build a business out of this incredible health setback? Walk us through that part.
So everything in the beginning was health related. So it was like supplements, nutrition, fitness. Like that was what I was focusing on. And I started working out very slowly and sort of built up somewhat quickly.
Didn't you do Ironman as well?
I did do Ironman.
It's amazing.
So what happened was I was getting healthier and I was starting to wean myself off my meds, and I was training to become an EMT, not as a career, just like I was just trying to learn everything I could about the body, and it was something that was interesting to me. So in that program, I met somebody who was a triathlete, and he convinced me to do one. We did it together, and it was a small Olympic distance triathlon. And I did that, and I was getting better and better. And then somebody, I can't remember who his name was, somebody who had just done an Ironman, a friend of a friend, was like, oh yeah, I heard you did a triathlon, you should do an Ironman. I was like, no way ever in a million years do I do an Ironman.
Not happening.
And my buddy who had gotten me to do the original triathlon sent me an email that night, and he was like, dude, Ironman France next June, are you in? And I was like, yes.
Wow.
So having that as a goal, I got a coach for the triathlon aspect. And so not only was I getting, so now I'm starting to get physically better. The training started to ramp up very quickly. Within a few months, I was doing 20, 25 hours a week of exercise, right? But I still had this business to deal with. I still had all this debt to get out of. So I had to figure something else out there. So I started writing with a friend, actually, this guy named Jameson Detweiler. We started writing a blog together about productivity hacks. It was really, there was no structure to it, no idea to it. He actually came up with the name Less Doing, which is really funny. And then I think we wrote like our fifth or sixth article, and then he started another company. And went off to do that. And I was like, well, I'll just keep doing this. It's fun. So I just kept writing about things that I was trying on myself. And I just basically saw myself as a constant lab experiment. Everything I was doing physically, mentally, and then in productivity in my work. And I wrote enough that it turned into an actual structure. And then there was a new platform that launched at the time called Skillshare, which originally was for people to teach in-person classes about anything they wanted. And I put out a thing to teach a class on like productivity tips. I think people paid $10 each. It was like 8 people. And I just went through like a list of websites, and it was really fun, and people were responding well to it. So I started doing that week after week and built out a real structure to the program that is now Less Doing. And after, I want to say my 7th class, this guy walked up to me at the end and he says, that was great. Do you do private coaching? I was like, yeah, I do. And it's this much. And this is how often we meet. It was $249 a month at the time. And that was my first coaching client. And then, so every time after that, I was like, oh, and I do private coaching, I'd pick up two or so. So within, I don't know, 2 years, I'd probably done well over 1,000 hours of coaching at that point.
Amazing. Well, I was one of them. Yeah. So I'm grateful for it. And so how many years later are we now from that?
From now?
Yeah. Today. How many years has it been that you've had Less Doing?
Less Doing technically started 8 years ago.
Got it.
So,
and so what's it look like today? It's not a $249 coaching experience.
No, very different now. And so I over the last couple of years, it's transformed from as much of a personal coaching program to much more of a business growth methodology, which again came through experimentation of building a company separate from this, different company entirely. And so now we have a program called The Replaceable Founder. And so we work with businesses at most levels, everything from really 300,000 up to 50 million at this point, to help make everyone in the organization as replaceable as possible.
I love that, because so many people are holding on so tight to their businesses, that certainly the entrepreneurs I spend time with and coach, and even people at all different positions in a company, sometimes think their value is to be irreplaceable. And I love that you're turning that on its head. What's the main resistance you find when you say, like, be the replaceable?
So a lot of people will say, well, don't you mean irreplaceable? And I always have to correct them and say, no, it's replaceable. There's a big difference between being irreplaceable and indispensable. We want everybody to be indispensable. No question about that. But irreplaceable is an enemy to the company. A liability, honestly, and including the founder. And as with an actual bottle, typically the bottleneck is at the top. So what's interesting about the way that I work is I've been able to work in pretty much every industry you can name, and very, very different sizes of companies. I don't have to make anybody better at what they do. I just have to give them more time to do what they do really well. So why focus is on unlocking constraints, unleashing teams, and making unstoppable businesses. So I'm not helping people create opportunities. I'm helping them take advantage of the ones that are in front of them by getting rid of the obstacles.
And I know you also really help with overwhelm, right? I think you've called yourself an overwhelmologist.
Yes.
And I'm excited to get into that in the next part of the podcast, because I think there's a lot of shifting of mindset around that that has to happen in order to get out of that mode, right, of overwhelm.
Yes.
It's like such an overused term today. It used to be everyone's busy. Now everyone's overwhelmed.
Well, it becomes an excuse.
Completely. I'm excited to dig into that with you in a minute. Coming up, why being busy isn't really a badge of honor, and how being irreplaceable can block your path to advancement. You know, success in business is really 80% mindset and 20% skill set and network. If you want help with the whole package and you're a woman business owner looking to scale up faster than you already are, then as a listener of this podcast, I have a way I can help. I'm going to give you a complimentary Accelerate session. It's a 45-minute coaching call on me. That means free. Go to scalewithjulia.com, scalewithjulia.com, and sign up. And then there's this. If you mention this podcast when you sign up for your Accelerate session, we'll also send you our exclusive ebook, Power Networking for Female Founders, also free. So that's two ways you can start scaling faster right now. Make sure you mention the Million Dollar Mind podcast. Again, go to scalewithjulia.com. When you meet people who say, I'm overwhelmed, what's the first thing that you have them think about or work on?
So the first thing actually is to make it seem even worse for them. Because the truth is, as I said, like, you need to get to a breaking point a lot of times. A lot of people actually wear overwhelm as a badge, as we know, right? Being busy is a badge of honor in a lot of cases. And that's unfortunate. And that's something that has to shift right away anyway. So what I like to explain is that the extreme version of overwhelm that I see fairly often is when you get to a situation, you get into a state in a place in your life where you feel like no matter what you do, you're going to disappoint somebody. Mm-hmm. And to sit with that for a second, right? Like, that's, you're either going to disappoint your family, your colleagues, your boss, your team, your clients, yourself, right?
So there's like a fear of failing.
It's more than failing. You know, disappointing somebody is different than failure. Failure is a very personal journey in some ways, but disappointing someone else is really a big deal. You know, when you have a founder, for example, who shuts down a company with 100 employees, a lot of times they're going to be fine. They'll bounce back to something, but it's 100 employees that really hurts the most. And that's a really hard place for people to be in, that they can't make a move without disappointing someone. That's really challenging. So I like people to sort of understand what that looks like, and sometimes that's what they feel like at the moment.
But if someone listening either themselves is dealing with overwhelm or has a friend who's like always overwhelmed, yep. I think we all have that person in our life who's always like, oh, I can't, I've got so much going on, and they don't realize that, you know, they are making a choice, right? They could actually find systems or work with someone who could help them come up with a different system. Have you seen any trends like personality types of people who just are attached to this overwhelm idea? Since this podcast is about mindset, I'm always interested in, is there a certain type of mindset that you've encountered where, okay, this is going to be a bigger challenge than someone else?
Yeah. So it's interesting because I would say that generally speaking, overwhelm as a concept that hurts people is really prevalent in my generation and the generation before mine. You don't see like 70-year-old people talking about overwhelm, even if they're working, right? Okay. Like, it's just not a thing, because most likely they've actually been through things that really were overwhelming to most people. And that's, relatively speaking, this is not that big a deal, right? But at the same time, I have people that I work with now who are my age who have been in war, you know, and they still get overwhelmed by the Excel spreadsheet that they have to do now. So it is a relatively young person's thing, I would say.
And do you ever get into like, how is that serving them? Because I know that sometimes when I have coaching clients who have a story that they're very attached to, you know, I sometimes try to shift things by saying, well, how is that serving you? Right? Because you say you want to get rid of it, but if it weren't serving you in some way, you wouldn't be holding on to it.
Yeah. And again, it's that idea of like busy being a badge, right? Mm-hmm. So if we're overwhelmed, then we must be doing something right, right? And we must be productive. And
you think it gives people a sense of significance sometimes? Like, I must be really important if I'm so overwhelmed and so...
Yeah. Yeah, I would say so. You know, the truth is that the world we live in now, a lot of the results that a lot of people produce are not very tangible. We might make lots and lots of money. We might make big impacts on people, but we're not producing, you know, 10,000 cars like, you know, an Elon Musk might, for example. So the tangible results are not always there, which is, I think, part of the problem. You can't point to things. It's actually one of the reasons that I used to really like real estate development when I was doing it, is because you could say like, I built that building, you know, and that was really exciting at the time. It's very different to say, I loved actually now when anytime people were like, what kind of results are you getting for clients? It's like, well, this client doubled their profitability. It's true, but it doesn't mean it. Like, you can't taste that, right?
Right. Or I got 30% of my time back.
Right. Which is wonderful, but it also, I can't see it, you know? Right. So the thing about overwhelm, though, this is going to sound very circular, but the reason that most people feel overwhelmed is because they don't know what's causing the overwhelm. So you ask somebody who's overwhelmed, you say, how do you know?
What does that look like? How do you do your overwhelm?
How do you know? And it's like, well, I just can't get to everything. Well, that's not overwhelm in itself, right? Overwhelm means that you are underwater, really, and like you can't see where you're going. That's what I would say. If we have a direction and we know where we're headed and we know sort of like what the water looks like around us, then overwhelm becomes a lot less of an issue. The biggest issue with overwhelm is a lack of visibility. If I were to boil down to one thing, that's what I would say. So if you look at somebody who has a to-do list, for example, in a notebook, that's a terrible thing to do. Everyone might gasp when they hear that. But to-do lists, as most people use them, are really anti-productive.
You don't even have one, right?
No.
You don't use that at all.
I do not use a to-do list. I use a project management tool mm-hmm. with my team, which is very different because it has some sense of beginning, end, and beginning, middle, and sort of completion, whereas most to-do lists don't.
So getting this visibility is super important.
Yeah, and a lot of that can come from tracking. So a lot of that is based in my biohacking sort of background, right? Is that if you track something, then you know what it is. Mm-hmm. So people might think like, oh, I'm jarring in emails, but it turns out that 80% of your emails are happening in an hour period of the day, which is not uncommon, by the way. Then just do email during that hour, if that's the case, right? Like, but you didn't know that. It just feels busy. You can't read the label from inside the jar.
Right. You just think this is not working and I don't know why. And they don't teach this stuff. That's the other thing.
They do not teach
it. And they really should. I mean, funny enough, my son is in middle school and they do start teaching them how to like manage their time, right? They like sit down with them and say, okay, you've got these binders, you've got this homework, here's how you should. Like, that's a thing now.
Yeah.
So, but it wasn't a thing when we were going through college. But I'm curious about the mindset part of overwhelm because I know that for myself, you know, I'm juggling a lot of things and I caught myself last week feeling like it's just too much. Like it's just too many things. Plus, I've just started this podcast, right? Like I just keep piling on more things. And then I stopped and I said to myself, wait a minute, what if you looked at it like I have so many opportunities all around me? How exciting, right? As opposed to I can't keep up with it all. How exciting that I have so many opportunities all around me. So I'm curious when you work with people, do you get into the mindset part? Do you talk about that? How do you do that?
So, I mean, look, if somebody's really, really overwhelmed, like they're just like losing it. I mean, I've had people cry on the phone with me plenty of times. Like that's not abnormal. Start by writing down what are the things that you think are overwhelming you. What are the things that you're doing? And just put it on paper and read that list. And a lot of times that alone, I know how simple that sounds, but a lot of times that alone becomes so much more clarifying because we have very limited working memory. That's a known thing. So, you know, if you're dealing with 10 things at one time, which is not unreasonable, especially if you have a family, you have a lot of things going on, your brain gets filled already with those things. And you're thinking about all those things at the same time. And so it just seems like you're full. There's nothing more that can happen, but you know that there's more things out there. So it's almost 100% mindset. The idea of overwhelm is 100% mindset, I would say, because if you could step outside yourself for a minute and say that, what if I wasn't overwhelmed? I mean, how would I deal with this problem, right? So you take that out of the equation. It's like, well, this person needs this and this person needs this. If I had $1 million at my disposal and 50 people working for me and I wasn't stressed out about this, how would I deal with this? Now you can start to attack it. Because if you can identify a sort of strategic direction for any of these problems, then it's really not a problem. It's just a matter of time and how you take, you know, one bite out of the elephant. It doesn't matter if you have 10 elephants to go through, you're still going to take one bite at a time, right?
And you can always kind of reverse engineer a process once you get out of that overwhelmed state. Because I know that when I'm feeling stressed and anxious, it's almost like I shrink, like I become less resourceful, I become darker, I don't see the solutions and the possibilities, I only see like, oh, that's one more thing I have to do. I mean, I love the story you told in the book, The Replaceable Founder, about your podcast and how you went through this evolution of like, you used to spend hours and hours and hours on it, and then you finally figured out a way of doing it where you spend very little time on it.
Yeah.
So is that like one of the processes that you help people with, is to figure out you're not overwhelmed, you just don't have a good system?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's so – it's a perfect sort of segue into this, is that I'd say that the biggest pain point that most people experience as they grow their companies or as they become entrepreneurs is that they don't actually understand what their real pain point is. So what I mean by that is that most people, as they grow, think that they need more people. And that is – I would say never the answer.
What do they need?
Systems and processes. And then you can bring people into it later. But if you bring people into a system that's not well-defined and quite frankly broken in a lot of ways, bringing more people into it is just going to weigh it down and it's going to make you frustrated and it's going to add to the overwhelm. But if you have a system and process in place that replaces the things that you do really well, then bringing people into it is amazing because then you start to expand it. But then as you bring those people into it, you need to have them in the mindset that they need to replace themselves with systems and processes as well, not so they can be replaced out of the organization, but so they can be replaced up.
Right. And move up. And yeah, actually, just someone who works with me just today said, you know, can we hire an assistant? Because I'm doing all these things that I don't think are good use of my time. And I was like, absolutely. That's a great idea.
Yeah. And you know how many people would never ask for that? When I was building the current iteration of the company right now, I went through a period where I was admittedly very purposefully overloading my team, but also giving them all the possible resources that they could need to delegate out and outsource. So every one of them had access to virtual assistants and other outsource providers. There was education opportunities, coaching support, so that the only way that they were going to be able to get the amount of work done that they were asked to be done would be to delegate it. Just forced it to happen. And that's one of the reasons why 2 years ago I had a team of 7 and now I have a team of 3 and we're doing 10 times the revenue.
Wow. Amazing. You applied that in your own business.
Yeah.
Now, tell me about the mindset shift you've seen in people. Like, what's the typical process? If you looked at how you help folks, but not from the, you know, optimize, automate, outsource. Did I get it in the right order? Mm-hmm. Yes.
Perfect.
Which is so helpful. But from the mindset perspective, how would you describe that journey?
So it's funny because a lot of people want to jump to the automate, the outsource stuff. I have a lot of people come to me and say like, I just need a new CRM, which I love that one. That's the most common thing ever. It's like, well, what do you need a CRM for? It's like, well, you know, we just have too many leads to handle. It's like, well, you know, what do you want to do with those leads? Well, we just want to follow up with them. Well, you don't need a CRM for that necessarily. So people often come to me with the solution rather than the problem. So that's where we usually start. Let's identify what the actual problem is. And I think that we get caught up in this sort of entrepreneurial space. And I think a lot of the coaching programs that are out there, not mine or yours, obviously, but I think they contribute to the problem because a lot of times people are like, well, I had this problem and I got this thing and it fixed it. And somebody's like, well, then I can do that. I can just pay somebody to do Facebook ads and everything's going to be great. Right? Like it just doesn't work
that way.
But
they don't think the same way as that person thinks.
Exactly.
Right. So yeah, we always start with mindset in my program because I say, you know, the results you have come from the thoughts you have. So if you want different results, we got to change the thoughts. And so what are the thoughts you help them change?
Well, and just to put a wrapper on that too, it's never, ever interesting to me to see what a successful person does. I'm more interested in how they think, right? Totally. And how they got to that. So we start with that idea, like start thinking about what the problem is, not the solution. The other thing is, which is a big shift for people, is everybody's in this sort of firefighting mode they like to talk about. And I try to shift that to fireproofing, right? So let's stop and think about, rather than fixing problems, how do we actually solve them? And that's something that I see is that's probably the biggest problem contributing to overwhelm, is that when problems come up, we play whack-a-mole, right? Like we just up and down. I'd rather stop and figure out how I can unplug the machine, you know,
totally
to stop the moles entirely.
Yeah.
Exactly. And when people say they don't have time to stop and make processes, that's like saying I don't have time to sleep. Like, it's just, it will catch up to you at some point.
And what's something you say to people that kind of stops them in their tracks and gets them shifting their thinking? Like, if they're like, well, I just have to do all these things and it's just like that. I've always been like this. And how do you get them to make that mindset shift?
So we have a metric that I use called time to departure. So we ask people, how many days notice would you have to give your team if you wanted to go on vacation? So most of the companies I talk to, it's over 30 days, which is really frightening. But then a lot of times you get some very smug people who are like, well, I could leave tomorrow. I'm like, okay, that's great. Now flip it around and let's say that one of your top people had to leave today. How many days would you have to step into their shoes, or would somebody else have to step in their shoes for? And they're like, oh, yeah, that's probably 30 days or more. So anything more than 72 hours to me is really frightening, because you have to think about what that means, right? If you can't be away from the desk for 3 days without something building up, without a bottle, like anytime you have people say that, oh, I have to catch up on something, I always stop them with that, because what do you have to catch up on? You shouldn't have to catch up on anything if there's a system in place. Because then all we're doing is sort of like biding our time, and it's almost like a pain tolerance issue. If somebody's like, well, I'm not going to look at email for 4 days because I'm going to go on vacation, but then I'll have to catch up for that entire day when I come back to vacation for the vacation. So that time to departure is usually a really big one for people. You start to think about, and if they do say it's 30 days mm-hmm. or more, then you really have to look at why is that? Like, what would happen in your absence? And they ultimately realize that if it's a situation where they have a time to departure that is 2 weeks or more, then they don't really run a business. They just own their own job.
Because they can't step out and it won't function without them. I always say my favorite moment as an entrepreneur is when I get on the plane for my summer vacation with my boys and I take out my iPhone and I delete my work email, because I don't trust myself to not look at it, because I do love what I do. But my team doesn't need me looking at it. The company functions without me, and I just delete it. And that's the moment where it's all worth it. All the coaches I hired, all the systems I put in place, like it's working without me. So it's great you help people do that. One last question about this whole mindset around overwhelm. Do you think that there's something that people feel about, like, not deserving to work, you know, smart, not hard, not to use a cliche, but there is something about, like, valuing yourself enough to let yourself work fewer hours? I find some people really struggle with that. I'm curious if you've seen that too.
Yeah, that's a totally valid sort of observation, but I actually don't see that as often as an issue. It seems more that it's not so much deserving. One of the ones is that we still are in this mode where I think people feel like they need to be the example of hard work a lot of times. So, you know, if the boss is working late, then I'm going to work late. Same kind of idea. And that doesn't mean anything, right? Hours present doesn't mean hours productive. Yeah. So I don't know if it's so much of a deserving thing necessarily. And then the other side of it is just a fear element that they don't think it's possible to do these things and have, you know, the balance and get it all done while still being seen as valuable and useful. And ultimately, you know, if you can't be replaced, you can't be promoted. So whatever that looks like for, and promotion is as relevant to an entrepreneur as anybody, because the promotion for an entrepreneur could be the next company, the big boat that they want to get, right? So if you can't be replaced, then you can't move up.
Well, that's a great shift in mindset right there, right? Because people who start out with, oh, being replaceable means not having value, right, when in fact it's the exact opposite, right? The more you've created systems where you can move up and somebody else, and also other people can step into leadership, right?
Yes.
There's that piece too.
That's right.
Like, who's not able to step into leadership because you're not stepping into your next.
Well, and that is leadership rather than management.
Yeah. Up next, why Ari calls himself an overwhelmologist and why entrepreneurial teams need protection from the entrepreneurial mind.
You can contact Julia at juliapimsleur.com. That's Julia, PIMSLEUR.com. Thank you for listening.
Ari, you've overcome some really intense obstacles, like health-wise, and also have built a company in a crowded space where there are a lot of people who want to help you, you know, get organized and be more efficient and all that, but you are doing it at a really big national successful level. So I'm curious, like, what's one mindset shift that you think you made that really contributed towards you being able to build all this and overcome these obstacles?
So I think that there's a really big element with the companies that we see growing, especially the entrepreneurial teams, the startups and whatnot, where at some point, and it's fairly early on, you have to start putting protections in place to protect the entrepreneurial team from the entrepreneurial mind. So
what is the entrepreneurial mind? How do you define that?
So the entrepreneurial mind is the one that gets an idea and then another idea and then another idea. And unfortunately, I think as entrepreneurs, we only know two time frames: now or never, right? And the never gets kind of bratty sometimes. Well, I don't want to do it now, and I never want to do it then. And or it's now. And the problem with that, what we see constantly, and this is going back to a fairly old term, but you're familiar with LIFO and FIFO inventory?
No.
No? Okay. Mm-hmm. It's like one of the oldest like accounting terms for inventory. So LIFO is last in, first out. FIFO is first in, first out. So grocery stores a lot of times are last in, first out, right? So the last milk is the first one out. Or no, other way around, sorry. FIFO. First milk is the first one out. You get into a situation very quickly with entrepreneurial teams where you get this LIFO thing going, meaning that the last thing that they hear you say is what they think is the new priority.
Ah.
See it
so
constantly.
They're off running, acting on that.
They're off running. Deadlines getting missed. Nobody knows why. It's like, well, because you put three other projects on their plate all of a sudden. We don't get to flesh those ideas out a lot of times. So a lot of the work that we actually end up doing is about that idea of creating a system to really put protection in place. You have to protect the entrepreneurial team that knows what they're doing and is more structured ultimately than most of the entrepreneurs that we deal with. And the entrepreneurial mind. And so when I have an idea now that I come up with, I've gained some discipline, and we've also put systems in place where there's a process that has to go through before I can really even present it to my COO in this case. We even go so far as we've created a worksheet that we use, which is called the 3W worksheet. And it's the what, and then the who and the when, and it's filled out by two people. So I decide the what, but somebody else, and in my case, it's my COO, she decides the when and the who.
Otherwise, it'd all be now or never.
Right. And and it could be now, right. But she's the one making that decision. And we agree on that. And there's a why to each one, you know. So, well, we're not going to do it now. We're going to do it next quarter. Why? Well, because this actually fits with the goals for next quarter. It doesn't fit with the goals for this quarter. You know, so that has been really, really fascinating. And then the other thing in relation to that, too, is that I've recognized this mostly in myself, but also with a lot of the entrepreneurs we work with, that entrepreneurs can be impulsive. We know that. And that's a good and a bad thing in different cases, but I've made impulsive decisions that were not the best decisions to add things to our plate and take on new opportunities. But fortunately, what I found is that my somewhat impulsive decisions to remove things have always served us really, really well. And it's an important distinction. You know, so for example, I made the decision in the last 24 hours, basically, that I'm not going to travel for the next year. And I've traveled six days, I think, this month so far. And traveling is a big part of what I do for speaking and networking events, things like that.
What prompted that?
I travel in a very efficient but very, very crazy way. So last week I was in San Francisco for 16 hours from New York, and two red eyes. And I had a four-hour delay on my flight back and missed my seven-year-old's performance at a school, which is the first time I've ever missed anything.
Oh.
And that sort of hit me. So initially, there's some fear around that, saying, well, we get so much business and I get so many clients and do all these things from speaking. But
hey, that's a new constraint, and you love constraints.
Exactly. Thank you. Exactly.
Your business is probably going to triple from you not traveling. Although it's funny, I had a similar thing when my book came out, Million Dollar Women. I was going to go on this national speaking tour, and then I realized I don't want to miss the time with my kids. So I didn't set that up, and it's actually what had me come up with my online business program so that I could run it from home. And, you know, I think we've reached a lot more people than I would have that way.
And now you got a podcast.
And now I got a podcast.
So, which is, I mean, it's true. It's a big key part of it. Also, the fact that, I mean, we're here in New York, right? So it's not like we can't find opportunities that are local.
Totally. And also, I don't know if you remember, like in high school, they used to give you those writing prompts, like, okay, class, you know, for an hour, we're going to write. And they'd give you a little prompt and then you'd have to write about something. Uh-huh. Sometimes that would like unleash all this awesome creativity. So I think you're right that the constraints sometimes help us to come up with cool new stuff. Whereas if someone said to you, like, you got an hour, here's a blank page, go. That would be harder.
Yeah. And the thing is I actually see constraints like a warm blanket, you know, like it's something to lean on. It's a security in some ways, whereas some other people might see that as, stifling creativity. And I think it's the exact opposite.
Cool. Well, that's a great mindset shift. So what advice would you have for someone who is like trying to shift their mindset away from, you know, I'm so overwhelmed, I have so much to do, I'm so busy, this is the only way to do this. What advice, like where could they start?
So it all starts with Optimize. It starts with those with that tracking and identification of how you're doing, what you're doing now, and what you're actually doing. And it could be that simple as literally like a time study of yourself. If you were to take 3 days and write down what you're doing every hour and just review that at the end of the day, I know that you would be amazed. Anybody listening to this would be amazed at what they actually do.
And that's what they need to put into practice. But what about the mental shift? Like, what do you think is the mental shift that has to happen first?
I think some of the mental shift comes from seeing that in some cases. But here's the thing is that we use an analogy of an engine for the business that we're talking about. And the people at the bottom level are cogs. So they're irreplaceable. Engine won't run out of the cog. The thing that keeps people in that position is fear. And the myth that we tell ourselves is that it's all about me. Mm. It's all about me. And the truth that we have to accept, then the only way that we can move up for that is if we accept the truth that it's not all about me. I'm not that unique. And I need to be more replaceable. And you start to free yourself up to see that. We don't want to replace you. We want to make you replaceable.
That's a really great distinction. Thank you. This is awesome. If you could share one thing that you've read or seen recently that's had an impact on you, specifically around mindset, like helped you think about things differently, gave you an aha moment, it could be a book on your nightstand, it could be a TED Talk you watched, what jumps to mind?
So it's not that recent, but it's the book Emergency by Neil Strauss. There's no like direct correlation necessarily that people could see, but essentially in the story, he had essentially like an anxiety attack after 9/11 and decided that if the world was going to end like again or somehow or zombie apocalypse or something, he needed to be more prepared for it. And he went on this whole sort of self-transformation and became a paramedic and learned how to be a pilot and got a second citizenship. And this just whole transformation was incredibly inspiring. And I was actually fortunate enough to interview Neil on my podcast, which is like one of my favorite interviews ever. But it's that idea of, you know, there's a problem. I'm going to do something about it.
Become the driver. Mm-hmm. Love it. Thank you. How do people find you, Ari?
So everything is at lessdoing.com. The podcast, the books, the our coaching programs, everything's there. And I'm at social media as at Ari Maizel most places.
Ari Maizel really did create that third option. He hacked his own successful future with systems and processes. And now he teaches other people how to do that too. Ari, thanks so much for being here and sharing so much of what you've learned with us. I learned many new things today that I can't wait to start implementing. And I hope for you listening that you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did, and you'll join us again for Million Dollar Mind. Until then, take one thing from what you heard Ari talk about today and apply it to your life. Maybe you can get rid of overwhelm and start building the systems and processes to get closer to your Million Dollar Mind. I'm Julia Pimsler.
Million Dollar Mind is a production of Mouth Media Network. Copyright 2019, Julia Pimsler.
This is Mouth Media Network, your inside voice.